Hey there, welcome to another episode of Close to the Vest. My name is Arthur Ettinger, and we talk all things relationship. I am so lucky to have in my office today the master connector, real estate extraordinaire, Jay Zinner. Jay, thanks so much for being here, man.
Wow, that's a very nice introduction. I'm flattered. I was going to say thank you for having me.
Today is special like the day. This is like opposite day.
Yeah.
This is the day when we turn the tables and like you that. Actually get interviewed.
You know what?
How do you feel about that?
I'm ready, I think. I mean, yeah, you're right. I'm the one that's usually doing the interviewing, but it's nice. Let's see how you handle it. Let's see how I handle it.
And I guess I don't know how I'm going to handle it, but I got to say, like, it's nice to not, you know, I'm the one who asks the questions normally, doing what I do, and so it was a bit weird when you did it. So I think you'll be awesome, and I'm grateful to have met you. We've only known each other for a short period of time, but thank you for coming here.
Thanks, man. Feelings mutual.
So before we jump into like real estate shit, let's talk about Diamondbacks, man.
Oh.
You Arizona boy.
That's such a great start. Thank you. Yeah, grew up in Arizona, had always sort of had this purpose, and I've told people who have asked me, why the hell would you go from Phoenix to New York? And I'm very certain that it was all of the time that I spent in front of Sesame Street and seeing how those kids played and seeing how just the street lined up and the architecture and everything about it just was amazing to me. And I always felt like this pull, like this gravitational pull to New York City. I had to get there somehow, some way. And even though I didn't have like a great passion or desire to go to law school or to become a lawyer, it was the ticket to New York that allowed me to get here. And that was back in 2000. So I spent the first 23 years of my life in Arizona and the second 23 years of my life now here in New York. But my heart still resides in Phoenix when it comes to my sports teams, since you brought up the Diamondbacks.
Sure.
And of course, they're relevant at the moment because they just finished playing in the World Series. Unfortunately, they lost. But just to have been there and to have had an opportunity to share that with my boys, who I've completely brainwashed into being just Phoenix sports fans,
so
for better or worse. Oh, yeah. Through and
awesome.
Through. Phoenix Suns.
I love it.
Diamondbacks.
You're doing
Cardinals.
Your part.
I'm doing my thing.
Can I tell you? Before you came in, I had Elliot here, and he was talking about like growing up with psychologists and how they were like, I'm like, did they push you to be a psychologist? He's like, no, they let me do my thing. And kudos to you for really being the parent and pushing and instilling, because I remember when I was a kid, and you know, now at 51 years old, I root for players more and representing players. But I grew up a diehard Yankee fan, and I remember when Dylan came home and he's like, Dad, I want to buy a Mets shirt. And I'm like, I'm not buying you a Mets shirt.
Right.
So I love it that you're ingraining your kids early.
Yeah, I just figured it was so important to me to have that, at least that connection with them. I mean, life is difficult enough. I can't imagine living in a household where we had separate sports interests. So it's my fault, and my older son primarily reminds me of how disruptive it's been and how much easier his life would have been had we not been Arizona sports fans. And I continue to try to tell him and teach him, like, there are cities that go decades without appearing in a finals, and he's upset that in 2021 the Suns lost to the Bucks up 2-0, devastating fashion, and now we've lost the World Series. He's like, what did you bring me into? So that's been the nature of our conversations of late. And yes, I am a big diehard Diamondbacks, Suns, and Cardinals fan. The only reason why I'm leaving the Coyotes out, even though I have a little bit of an interest as to how they're doing, is only because they play there. I never played hockey. I didn't grow up with hockey. So it's harder for me to get into that sport. But certainly if they were in the Stanley Cup or the Stanley Cup playoffs, my loyalty would be to them as well.
So I just want to go back. Your son is upset because his team's in the playoffs all the time.
He's a spoiled brat.
That's hilarious.
Yes.
So I know the story. I want you to tell the story because I love this. This really hits home for me, how you were grappling with taking the boys to back home to see at least a game during the World Series. So share that struggle you had and what it was like to go. I know they didn't win, but that's just an awesome experience.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if it was the way that I was raised or the way that my mind has started to sort of view the world, but as a kid, I had always had this sort of strong desire to be involved in sort of big moments, big experience, and my parents weren't always in a position to afford me those opportunities. And I wasn't the type of kid who pressed. I kind of knew what situation I was in, and if I had to watch a big game or, you know, share a big moment via a television or a radio, that was perfectly all right with me. But I always kind of had in the back of my mind that if I were ever in a position financially or otherwise to share those experiences with my children, who I hoped shared in similar interests with me, whether they were boys or girls or whatever, that I would try to find a way to do it. And so an opportunity arose when the Diamondbacks went on this wonderful run and finally made it to the World Series, which had been 22 years, right? Mm-hmm. The team hadn't been to the World Series since 2001. And here they are, and I had promised my kids that if they were to make the World Series, that Daddy would find a way to get there. Awesome. And so I found myself cheering Game 7, obviously for the Diamondbacks to win, but in the back of my mind, oh my God, how much is this going to cost me? And is it going to cost me my marriage on top of the financial burden that's going to be? So we won. We beat the Phillies in a somewhat miraculous way. Two games in Philadelphia where no one thought any baseball team could win a game. And our boys came through, and I started to get on the phone. I got to find plane tickets, and I got to find tickets to the game. Now, lucky for me, I have a friend who works for Major League Baseball, and I thought of him very quickly to see if he could help arrange getting me tickets. It was up to me, obviously, to find other arrangements to get myself there and the boys there. And then it was presenting this rare opportunity to my wife, who's much more sensible and grounded than I am. And at first, she was like, it's just a sporting event. What's the big deal? You're not going to take the boys out of school. You've got a high school son. You've got a boy in sixth grade. They got to get their work done. This is going to be expensive. What are you doing? And she was right. I mean, what am I doing? Right. It's just a game. But it's not just a game.
No.
It was a once-in-a-lifetime bucket list item for me. And as much as it was for my boys to experience it, it was for me. I needed that moment them that I would never forget. And I'm starting to feel like it's those experiences that you have that make life worth living.
Yeah, and you know what? It wasn't just for you. They just won't appreciate it until they have a full head of white hair, you know? Like to this day, 1980, Yankees, Dodgers, I remember we left school early. I grew up on Long Island. I remember we took like one of my buddies, Andrew, we like went into the city. We went to Patsy's and went to Yankee Stadium. It was like amazing, you know? And like they will remember that. And that is your legacy that you're creating. So kudos to you, man.
Thank you, man. And it's, you know, it's funny that you mentioned your own story, because it was those same New York stories that I was so enthralled with as a kid. The Sesame Street watching kid, the kid who grew up with the television that was all based in New York and the movies that were all based in New York that I loved. And you'd constantly hear these stories about kids being taken out of school or ditching school to go see a Brooklyn Dodgers game in Ebbets Field or go to Yankee Stadium. And Billy Crystal, I think, tells a story about how he was 7 or 8 years old and he loved the Yankees and he was growing up and he was watching them on TV and they were his heroes. And I don't know what kind of means his parents had, but one day his dad took him out of school and took him to Yankee Stadium for his first game. And he says in his story, which I just will never forget, he goes, "It was the first game I saw in color."
I love that.
How powerful these moments were for kids who grew up on the East Coast or with baseball teams. I didn't grow up with the baseball team. The Diamondbacks are relatively new. They've only been around 26 years. So I'm 46. So I got a team at 20. I was a big Suns fan at the time and a pretty big Cardinals fan. I was thrilled to have a baseball team in my life that I could now cheer for. But it wasn't something that I had an opportunity to have those kinds of stories with. And so that was also a part of like, I get to take my kids out of school, get them on a plane, go back home, do something that we would never think to do otherwise, and share this experience.
Did they get it? Were they psyched to be there?
Oh, so psyched. That's so awesome. Psyched. Screaming and yelling and just carrying on. We got there 3 hours early, took in batting practice, saw how the stadium opened up and the roof opened. It was really just
And you're still married.
And I'm still married.
That's awesome.
I came home to a wife who accepted all three of us back.
And they lost.
Yeah, and they lost. Thanks for reminding me.
You think they're back next year? This is a fluke?
it wasn't a fluke, but sports are fluky. You know, sometimes on paper, the better team doesn't always win. I mean, if you ask the gambling public or any sort of sports prognosticator who was supposedly best positioned to win the World Series, it was neither the Rangers or the Diamondbacks. But you get a club who plays really, really good baseball together at the right time of year, and any baseball team can almost beat any baseball team, as we saw.
Baseball.
And it's the best. And the Diamondbacks, I will say, to gloat a little bit, are playing a brand of baseball that fits today's game. They're speedy. They play great defense. They're taking advantage of the larger bases, the pickoff rules. They're stealing bases. They're putting pressure on other teams' defenses and pitchers. And they're scrappy. They're a bunch of slap hitters. They use the entire field. They don't have big power bats. They don't have big all-star names. But they're built in such a way with such a framework that I think it is sustainable. But I wouldn't go out on a limb and say, you know, for the next 3 years, you're going to see the Diamondbacks in the World Series, although that's my hope.
So I would not agree with everything you said.
Okay.
But I do think it is a monster wake-up call for those big market teams. I love how scrappy the Diamondbacks are. Baseball is pitching and defense, and the way analytics has kind of tilted the sport to certain way of looking at things. And I think what the Diamondbacks has shown is it's not all about analytics. To your point, you got to ride the wave, you know, but in any event, we got a lot more to talk about.
So I could go on forever about that too.
Well, congratulations.
Thank
for
you.
Being
thank
there.
You.
And that's awesome.
Thanks experience. For bringing it up.
Of course.
I love talking about it.
So your real estate powerhouse, how'd you get into, just explain your journey about how you got to be the real estate lawyer you are now.
So everything in my life seems to happen by way of accident. I came here to New York, as I mentioned, to pursue a law
degree. Sesame Street.
Sesame Street pushed me to New York. I ended up getting here, attending Cardozo Law School, not having any particular passion or sort of purpose other than to do as well as I could, potentially get a job in a law firm, or graduate from law school and use my law degree to do any number of different things that my parents had promised would be available to me if I got a higher level of education than just my undergraduate University of Arizona education.
You have an interesting, similar background on that.
Yes, absolutely, which we can talk about if you'd like.
It's all good.
Come to New York, go to Cardozo, graduate from Cardozo, and I hang a shingle. I go out on my own.
Ballsy,
because that's just
it.
Who I am, right?
You didn't want to go work
It's not that I didn't want to go. It's just a question of how much effort did I want to put forth to try to get some sort of middle of the road job in a law firm where I really didn't have much control over my life, over my work. And I don't know what part of my brain suggested that, you know, trying to go out there and fend for yourself and find clients with very little experience, if any at all, was going to be possible. But I kind of said to myself, look, I have a strategy. I'm going to go out and see if it works, which we can talk about if you'd like. If it does, great. I'll start to build a practice around it. And if it doesn't work, then I'll find other work to do. But my friends who did super, super well in school, they were on the law journal. They found themselves getting offers at some of these bigger firms,
sure.
The Cadwalladers, you know,
the big
law. And they were getting like $125,000 to start. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of money. And I have a lot in student loans. And that sounds interesting. But every single day and every single week that went by with friends that had these jobs, they talked about how miserable they were and how many hours they were spending and how they lost their social lives. And, you know, I was
so
still
true.
Out having a good time, struggling. I wasn't living in the same way, maybe with the same financial comforts that they were, but I always kind of believed in myself that I would make it. So I started basically, just to be very brief about it, I started defending foreclosure matters in Connecticut.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, and had I been a little bit wiser and maybe a little bit more financially backed, I could have been a character in The Big Short, the movie. Because the writing was on the wall. And a lot of people blame the banks for the crisis. Yes, they were a part of this, but my clients were just as greedy about saving their homes as the banks were with what it was that they were trying to achieve by giving, you know, non-documented mortgages to people who didn't otherwise qualify. So I ended up running into a bit of a situation with one of the foreclosures. It scared the hell out of me because I was going to see this woman and her child and her mother who were living in Connecticut potentially lose their home. And I said, is this really why I went to law school? And so without boring your audience or boring you with too many details, I came back to New York to focus on what was my next path. And I ended up getting very lucky and finding the mentor that I so desperately needed because I hadn't worked at any firm before, Neil Dobzhinsky, who continues to be a very prevalent source for me and relationship that I have that I'm very grateful for. He's, as I refer to him, a walking CPLR. He's like the Wizard of Oz behind Dorothy. I'm Dorothy.
Awesome.
I get to, you know, kind of go down the yellow brick road, and I always have Neil on my shoulder kind of advising me and telling me which path to take. And having him in my life has totally changed my life forever and for the best.
Does he know you feel this way?
Oh, I hope so. That's I think so.
Well, did you tell him?
I do in many ways. I think he knows how much I appreciate him. I love him. He's like a father figure to me. He's been a very important part of my professional journey. And part of that relationship led me to B&I. So he was with a partner at the time who was working with a gentleman by the name of Larry Sharp, who's actually run for governor of New York on the Libertarian ticket and now finds himself on the airwaves and talking about political things quite frequently. He still has political aspirations, and I touch base with him from time to time, but he was doing business consulting, sales consulting. He was also coaching and doing some of that, and he was working with Neil's partner, Preethi. And both of them, Preethi and Neil, said, wouldn't it be great if Jay met with Larry? And I was open to anything. I'm 29 years old at the time. I just met Neil and Preethi, started to work with them on a couple of cases and a couple of things. Neil was overseeing some of the work that I still had in Connecticut, and I trusted any opinion that they had of me and what I should be doing to build my business. And they said, Jay, we think you probably would be great. And I go, all right, I'll give it a try. I'll meet with Larry. I met with Larry. Larry agreed. Larry said, you're coming with me to Morton Steakhouse at 7 a.m. on Wednesday morning. What time? 7 a.m. That's when I'm watching SportsCenter on loop. I'm not going anywhere
at 7 a.m.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a strip. They were like bringing in bagels and croissants or whatever. We had this little mezzanine level. I think we're on 45th Street at the time. And I remember that, you know, to be a serious anything, that was a great hour to get things done. Like to have an excuse as to why you couldn't meet other professionals who were going to help you build the business is, you know, embarrassing to have an excuse. So I said, Larry, I'll be there. And I showed up and I couldn't believe it. It was a bunch of people sitting around a table and they were talking about what they did very, very quickly and briefly. And then at the end of the meeting, they were hoping to receive a little white slip of paper that said, I have a referral for you. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, there's got to be more to this. I didn't take it real seriously at first. I'd show up late. I kind of thought it was a little bit of a goof, like, come on, this can't, no one can be really taking this so seriously. And at some point, I think it was like after year one, someone tapped me on the shoulder. I think it was Mike Ross, the president at the time. And he said, you know, our vice president is leaving the chapter. Is this something that you'd consider doing? You go, wow, that's interesting. Leadership position. All right, let's give it a go.
Mike Ross, like the ethics lawyer?
No, different Mike Ross. But also a good guy. I don't know if Mike Ross, the ethics lawyer, is a good guy, but Mike Ross, the one that I'm referring to, is a good guy.
Cool.
And he asked me to be the vice president, and like my whole life changed from there. I felt a whole new level of respect and responsibility for the people that were in that room. I was never late again. I never missed a meeting. And I actually felt like if I was going to sit at the front of the table and try to preach what I thought made for good relationship building, a good way to build professional relationships and personal relationships, I better do the walking before I do the talking. So I better bust my ass in introducing these good people who I trusted at that point to other people in my life, keep my ear open for any opportunity, walk into that room every week, ready to go, fired up, ready to help people. Because there's no way that they were gonna listen to my spiel or trust in me and my ability if I came in empty-handed every week, didn't do the one-to-ones, didn't try to build the relationships in the room, and I just continue to say, hey, here's what all you people should go out and do, and yet I'm not doing it. So everything changed for me. And for the last 15 years, and to answer your question, you said, how did the real estate thing happen? I was litigating at the time. Neil is a litigator. Neil was teaching me litigation. We were doing all sorts of civil litigation at the time, taking on whatever we thought we could handle successfully for people in a variety of ways. And then all of a sudden I started to get like tapped on the shoulder again. JD, do you real estate? I said, no, but I have somebody I can refer you to. And then it was like the next day it was like, hey, Jay, do you do real estate? I go, no, it's funny. Like just yesterday someone asked me, but I have someone for you. Right. And then I kept referring it out. I'm like, wait a minute. Maybe I should figure out how to do real estate transactional work. And slowly but surely, I started to build that part of my practice to a point now where the litigation is almost completely pushed to the side. And my entire focus is on the real estate.
How much of your practice is litigation? Or is-
I would say there's probably 10% of my time is focused on handling the cases that I have. I don't talk about myself as a litigator so much anymore, only in the context of me maybe being in a better position to help my clients from a real estate perspective understand the provisions of a contract differently than most transactional attorneys who've never litigated before. But otherwise, I think most of my time now is spent, you know, helping and handling and working out whatever issues there are in a real estate transaction. So that's a brief story of how my real estate sort of law developed.
Do you do only residential or you also do some commercial real estate?
Very little commercial. Again, it's nothing that I've had any experience doing. Sure. I've read a few leases for Elliot from time to time when he's like, hey, can you do me a favor? This is not a major situation. And sometimes I'll go to Neil and be like, Neil, have you done? Of course he's done this. Right. So I'll ask him for help. Maybe a second set of eyes will work. And I've negotiated a few leases that are very simple and straightforward. But like the real big technical stuff, the purchasing and sale of a building, I haven't done before. Sure. So I'm strictly focused on the residential.
So I got to do it because it's a relationship divorce podcast. So I got to at least touch upon it. I see we're dealing with real estate transactions all the time incident to the divorce. And, you know, my sweet spot is high conflict. You know, I'm dealing with people who will often, they won't at least agree early on how they're going to dispose of the real estate. But at some point, they get to a point where the marital residence or the second home, what have you, has to be sold. And sometimes it's amicable, and that's great, and we can talk about that. But I would like to talk about you as the real estate lawyer inserted into that nasty situation. Even the easy divorces are going through a cheese grater for the individual, and now we're going to bring in another set of lawyers, the real estate lawyer. So can you just touch upon that? I know you've had some experience. What's that like representing the individuals in the context of a divorce?
So it's a good question. I have had some experience handling and dealing with the sale of a matrimonial primary residence. I've also been involved in a few secondary homes, vacation homes, and things of that nature. And you know better than I how emotional a matrimonial case can be. And when it comes to money, you know, it's never peaceful. Unless, again, the people want to be peaceful and it's a 50-50 split or they've worked it out, and that makes my life much easier. But in terms of like the transaction itself, I will treat like any other transaction. I will have a client that's being referred to me who also has a matrimonial attorney. I obviously, my job, as I like to tell people, my job is not to negotiate business terms of any contract. The real estate agent negotiates the real estate business terms. The matrimonial attorney, much like yourself, will have already, hopefully, prior to my involvement, negotiated the terms of what the real estate deal looks like.
Hopefully.
I have to stay out of that as much as possible and just memorialize what's already been negotiated. And that's the easiest and best way for everybody to avoid trouble.
So true.
When my client then tries to use me as a weapon against either his or her own matrimonial attorney or real estate agent because emotions are high, I will try to act more as counselor, psychologist, to try to cool and ease any tension that I'm sensing so that I don't get myself stuck in the middle of something that I don't belong in the middle of. So what I will do is, with permission, turn my attention to the matrimonial attorney or to the real estate agent, we have a situation here. It seems as though there's been a change of heart, a change of mind. There's a complexity that maybe wasn't discussed before that's being shared with me. Let's get this worked out. I'm a peaceful guy. I look to try to create harmony wherever I can. So as much as possible, I'm looking to memorialize the deal and help make the deal go through. If there's an issue that does, it's unrelated to the real estate aspect of it and it's matrimonial, I turn back to the matrimonial attorney to say, you're gonna have to work with X, Y, or Z on this issue, or go back to the other side and work it out. So I've handled things that way. I hope that answers your question.
It does. I think about all these horror stories, and like when you have, so I often will carve out different constructs when there's a sale. Are we having step downs? If there's a disagreement on the listing price, who's gonna be, you know, is the broker's recommendation gonna govern? And there are a lot of times, you know, you have to fix garbage. That's what lawyer, like, it doesn't always act cleanly. Someone comes to me with the document signed. Invariably, they're coming to you with the document signed. You're saying, okay, go deal with the matrimonial lawyer. But what happens in the instance where now they're coming to you, they're like, oh, here's my little pretty settlement agreement, and it's completely silent. Now you become the go-between, and that's the last place you want to be.
Yeah, so I, not so recently, but recently enough where this might make sense to your audience and to you, is I was referred a residential real estate matter. There was a matrimonial attorney who was handling the affairs of the wife. I then represented the wife as it was a referral from the matrimonial attorney to me. And to this day, and we probably transacted 5 years ago. To this day, I'm still holding money in escrow.
Are you serious?
Because the proceeds of sale were being discussed and fought over as a result of monies that the wife believes is still owed to her by the husband for a variety of things, and they still have not worked all of the details out. So there's a good chunk of money that is still sitting in my account, waiting for them to come to terms with what it is that's going to be shared or not shared.
I've had countless cases where I'll get emails from the real estate lawyer, you know, you have until this date, we don't want to hold the money in escrow.
Right.
Who likes holding money in escrow? I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
You got to deal with that. That sucks.
Yeah. Although I will say, for as much as that sucks, and it really doesn't because it's not really affecting my life all that much, is as a result of my handling of that particular transaction, I have what seems like a lifelong client, someone who turns to me in many respects and has referred other transactions where her friends are involved because she liked how I handled the situation, handled the matrimonial attorneys, handled the real estate agents, and so on and so forth. Very complimentary. And the real estate agent that had the listing, who was brought on by the husband, who I did not represent, took a liking to me through that process and now is very loyal to me and sends me most of his work, if not all of
his
work.
That's awesome.
So as much as it's a bit of a pain to be involved still in holding monies, a lot of good has come out of that.
Yeah, and they say, you know, they say in that, like in that seminar, John Shaw, he talks about, you know, a lot of good comes out of something bad or tragic. And not that it was tragic, but you cultivate relationships and you're going to reap the rewards. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
So what words of wisdom do you have for that person who's listening, who's embarking on a divorce or maybe is knee deep in it, and they do have real estate that they're going to have to dispose of, whether now or in years to come?
Wow. That's a good question. I was going to answer it in a slightly different way, but since the focus is still real estate, it's to, before you make any decision with regard to disposing of the real estate, it's probably best that either party or both parties look to someone such as myself or even a real estate agent to some extent and get some advice on the different ways in which a property between two people who are splitting up their relationship and their marriage might want to either hold on to the property for the purposes of renting it and having some, generating some income that could be beneficial to both parties. if it were to be sold, what are the potential outcomes of a sale from a tax perspective? How the asset is being divided. And so don't just jump into making a decision because you think the best and easiest thing to do is to just sell the house and split it up the way
so
that you
smart.
Assume. Get some information beforehand, and there might be ways in which your negotiation with your spouse, who you're now no longer getting along with and wanting to get divorced from, that could maybe make things a little bit easier for you in terms of the real estate if you know more about the different ways in which you can use that in a positive way.
I couldn't agree more. So you and I spoke yesterday for like 10 minutes and we were talking about some horror stories and, you know, and then it's funny because this morning I was on the phone with a client and they're doing a buyout and we spent 45 minutes talking about ways to deal with the transfer tax. And a lot of people believe that, you know, a transfer between two spouses is zero consideration, no tax. And that is true, but incident to a divorce, it is not. And a lot of people try to fit the proverbial fucking square peg in a round hole. Share the story because people need to hear this. You know, everyone's so quick to cut corners and how it can bite you in the ass.
Yeah. So I was involved. It's the one and only time that I've been involved in such a situation, but it was an interesting one and one that I learned from and quickly advised my client as to how to best handle. And they were relatively amicable. Their relationship had clearly come to an end. It had run its course. They had a child together. They were both supportive, loving parents. They just weren't supporting loving partners anymore, and they felt it would be best to just go their own way. So a lot of what went into the matrimonial part of separating themselves from one another was relatively peaceful. To get to the real sort of heart and meat of the story is there was two properties. There was one in New York City, and there was a property in Virginia. And the two of them believed it would be probably easiest if they just said, you know what, you take property in New York City, I'll take property in Virginia. They're basically worth the same amount of money. Maybe one is worth more, but I don't care because I want Virginia because I have horses. You have the city because that's where you work and that's where you play, and so you should have New York. And they worked it out like that. Now, they did their deed.
And mind you, that happens a lot.
It does, okay.
You know, like horse trading, whatever it is. I'm going to take this, you're going to take that, but there are implications.
Yeah, well, and this is what I'm getting at. So they make this trade, they think that everything's fine, my guy gets a deed, and then like several months later, there's an audit. And I'm like, what could this possibly be about? Why is there an audit? What are they looking for? And so there's this letter that comes with it that says you owe $12,000-something in transfer taxes. So my initial thought was, no, they don't. It was a non-consideration deed. I do them all the time, transferring from an individual into an LLC or from partners into one of the names or whatever the case might be, and there's no transfer tax that's usually involved. And I'm thinking to myself, what the heck is going on here? But because there is value being received in the trade, it's just not liquid, there's still transfer tax that's owed to the city and the state when you do this kind of, as you mentioned, a horse trade, right? A one for one. So it's you have to, when you go into this negotiation with your matrimonial attorney, assuming it's Arthur, you have to be aware that there is an expense to that kind of trade-off, that the city and the state still expect you to pay on the value of the New York property. And
yeah,
my client didn't know that. So it was a $12,500 bill that came unexpectedly that I had to be the bearer of bad news on.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that person has called their malpractice carrier. That Matt lawyer. Anyway, I know we've kind of touched upon this. I know the answer, but I'd like the audience to hear. What separates you from the rest of the real estate lawyers here in Manhattan?
Interesting question. Let's see how I want to answer this. So I will say this to you. I have a lot of respect for the residential real estate bar in general. My relationships across the board, which I really like to maintain, and I'll explain to you why, in a very sort of healthy way with my counterparts who I work with repeatedly, because it seems to be a small group of us that practice in this area. And the better your relationship is with the other attorneys who you have respect for.
I love that you're going down this road.
Okay. Well, it's the truth.
I'm just going to shout that out.
It makes my job so much easier and helps me achieve what my clients ultimately want. My clients do not hire me to get into some sort of a fracas or a fight or some long drawn out negotiation. They want to buy an apartment or they want to sell an apartment. Things come up all the time. I don't have to bore your audience with a number of issues that come up from time to time. They can all be worked out when you have respect for the other side and you're a good communicator. So the attorneys that are doing deals with me, their clients are either wanting to buy or sell. My clients are either wanting to buy or sell. And so the only thing that can complicate that is a lawyer over lawyering. Get out of the way. Figure out a way to just figure it out. And if one lawyer in the transaction, which can be me, and it helps to have it explained to me how it can be worked out by the other lawyer, great, let's fix it together. Let's not overcomplicate this. So the people that I work with, for the most part, I have a wonderful relationship with. I'm not any better. I think that obviously my personality type is such that I'm caring. I really want to get the job done for my clients. I want to be there and available to them to explain the nuances of the transaction. It's usually the biggest investment of their lives, which can be scary. I have experience looking at the due diligence, looking at the financials, and helping them make a good decision. But otherwise, I just try to stay out of the way, let the process take its course, and be available to them and be a good communicator. And that's it.
Great answer. I can't tell you how many times I say, A, to a lawyer on the other side who just wants to fight with me for nothing. I say, we're not getting divorced, they are. You know, and that's usually a lawyer who doesn't really practice matrimonial, and they think they got to fight with you on everything. But on the client side, how can you getting along? How can you, you know, and you have to be careful. Certainly on, it's a bit more adversarial. You know, you go into a courtroom and you're outside waiting. A lot of times you show up, there's, it's like a cattle call, and there's a lot of people waiting. Not so much now post-pandemic. And you go give the person a hug, you might have had dinner with them a week ago. Why are you giving them a kiss on the cheek?
Yeah, it's like,
and a deal gets done so much easier when you can, when you have a great working relationship on the other side.
You know, and a lot of what we do, as you bring that up, is somewhat theatrical. You know, if you have an angry client who's looking for revenge and they see you kiss your adversary, they're going to question whether or not your loyalty is to your adversary or
that's
to them
fair.
Who's angry. And I'm not suggesting, because I'm a lot like you.
Right.
You know, I want to befriend people because, and again, this is going to sound manipulative and it's not intended to be, but I have found that you get more with an approach much like ours in getting for your clients what they ultimately want. It's like losing the battle to win the wars because you have a bigger macro picture in mind. But I have noticed that when I have been a little bit too lenient or too soft or too forgiving, or why did you give in on that? A client who's really about, you know, getting their way and it's their way or the only way, they've criticized me. Like, Jay, it would have been nice. Like, you're our lawyer. Like, you're supposed to go to bat. And I go, I am going to bat for you. I'm getting you the bigger part of this because we're giving in on this. And obviously, right. I don't do anything without my client's authority. But there's a way in which we treat each other professionally within our industry to help our clients get what they want at the end of the day. How much easier is it for you when you have a good relationship with your adversary than it is if you have a relationship that's antagonistic, it's full of...
Yeah, and the judge doesn't want to see the two lawyers fighting.
Right.
And I think you have to walk a fine line. I'm not going to kiss somebody if my client is all charged up. But at the same time, I'm not also going to listen to, well, they're the same person who says, well, the lawyer on the other side, they're an asshole. Like, maybe it's your spouse who's driving the bus there, and maybe you did certain things to make your spouse crazy, or they're nasty. It's not the lawyer.
I've also been told that it's 2023 and I have to stop kissing and hugging so much these days. I could get myself into some trouble. But yes, I am a kisser and a hugger. I'm a lover.
So good.
At the end of the day.
There you go. There's another reel right there.
Yeah, exactly.
So... I want to pivot now. You know, you do a lot of marketing. You talked about your networking group, you know, which changed your trajectory. It's really a compliment to you how you, you know, command the room. I never thought at this, I am not a networking group guy. But the energy that is in the networking group, and that's a testament to who you are, okay? I think that translates into so many different walks of life, and you will say giver's gain. And yes, that's true in business, but if you hold yourself out in that same philosophy in personal relationships, relationships are going to flourish. Can you speak to how you bring that energy, the giver's gain, okay? Not the kissing other people, but how the giver's gain mentality, do you walk that walk with your wife at home?
Interesting. I probably could do a better job of being a better giver to her. And we talk about it. She's a psychologist and a wonderful psychologist.
Oh, I'll get to that in
a second. Okay. And there are times where she reminds me that I might be taking for granted what's easiest in my life. So the things that are easiest in my life are the relationship that I have with my parents, my family, and my immediate family, my wife and my children. And at times I have to be reminded that I can get overly obsessive with this need, this desire. I don't know what it is. It's part of my makeup. It's part of what's been learned. A combination of the two, that I go out of my way sometimes, not to avoid the family, but to do things extracurricularly that will position myself so that I can continue to be that person that I think is so important. I play in a Sunday football game. I play poker with a variety of different people at different times. I enjoy going out for dinner. I enjoy being with my friends. And they don't always include my children and my wife. And so there is a balancing act, which I'm still trying to get better at. And what's wonderful about my family is that they understand the need that I have, and they usually leave me alone. But there are times where I'll get a little ribbing, like, hey, Daddy, can you pick your head up from the phone so we can just have some time together?
I get that.
And so I have to be reminded that sometimes there is an appropriate time to put the phone down. But in answering your question, this concept, this B&I, giver's gain, and I think it's just a general philosophy. The more you give, the more you get. And it's really not even about the get. Giving is such a selfish act. People don't realize that giving feels so good. If you can help someone, there's such a rush to have them looking you in the eye and say, Jay or Arthur, whomever it is, thank you so much for thinking about me. Thank you so much for connecting me. You have no idea how this helped me. You have no idea how this changed my life. Like, I don't need the reciprocity. And just hearing it is enough for me. And again, I don't even want to sound like I need to hear a thank you. But it's such a thrill to know that you've helped someone. And so I guess I'm addicted to that rush. I want to be in a position to help as many people as possible. And what it's translated into is this, and again, it might be just imagined, but there's this sense that I have like 300 people at any time that if I picked up the phone or texted right now during this podcast and said, I need your help, I need a favor, can you do this for me? Can you meet me tonight or tomorrow? They would drop anything and do it. And that is such awesome. A powerful feeling to
what
know that you
have. What
would
happen during this podcast that you would need somebody's help? No, I'm joking.
God forbid, maybe if you came across the desk and kissed me and hugged me, I don't know.
There's too many trinkets on right. the table. Anyway, so I get it, and I think you do a fantastic job of that.
Thanks, man.
And so kudos to you.
Thank you.
You know, I think there are certain people it comes really easy to, others not so much.
Yeah.
And for you, it definitely comes really easy, and it's not as easy as it seems. And I think it takes a special person. So
thank you for that. But there is a little bit of a disconnect in me in accepting that as the reason behind why certain people find themselves more easily positioned or more easily able to do what we just described. I think that no matter who you are, what line of work you're in, what personality type you have, this can be learned. You can start to develop a comfort level with the people that you engage with, whether it's 10 people per week, 100 people a week, 1,000 people a week. I now with social media, much like you and Christina have developed, you have followers. You have people that you might not even know who are going to listen to this or watch this in some way, shape, or form. Something's going to resonate with them, and they're going to go, you know what, that Arthur guy, he really seems like someone I'd like to get to know, or someone that I would use to help me in whatever matter it might be, right? So I don't want anybody to excuse their efforts because they feel like their profession doesn't allow for as much contact, human contact, like you and I have. We're trusted advisors. Our clients come to us because we're experienced and we're knowledgeable, and they start to trust the things that we say. Sure. I don't care what you do or how you work or who you work with. If you go out of your way to find opportunity for yourself, to take an interest in other people's lives, and you ask them questions, the amazing things that you'll discover about other people and their need to want to be made to feel, one, important, and to be made to feel that they're worthy of your help, is all you need.
Awesome.
It's all you need. And that's what has changed my life. And again, maybe to some extent I should be grateful and feel blessed that it maybe comes more easily or more naturally for me. But again, I don't think that there's anybody that I've ever come across that's not capable of doing it, if they want to. Some people don't desire it. I mean, you know, there's different strokes for different folks. Sure. But if this is the kind of life you want to live, and this is the kind of relationships that you want to develop, and you have time to develop these kinds of relationships and have them. I mean, it's hard work to maintain 300 relationships or 400 relationships. Now, Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram and networking meetings make it easier. So sure. I'm grateful for that, because it's not just about a bunch of phone calls throughout the week. When we were little kids, if you wanted to see a friend, you'd have to kind of stay in touch via a phone. We didn't have computers. So now it's much easier. But again, that's me. But again, anybody that's looking for that, I think it's possible. It just takes a little bit of training.
Amen. So you talked about your wife's a psychologist. What's that like, being married to a psychologist?
Well, you know, she's an extremely important part of my life. She's an appendage. I mean, I don't know what my life would be like without her. Her and I are so different on so many levels, and we talk about it, and we're such good friends, and I feel like the essence of our relationship has now morphed into, and sometimes I don't do a good enough job of paying particular attention, and again, I'll be reminded of that, how important it is to at least have discussions at the end of the day as to how we're both doing and check in with each other. But I think the real core and the essence, the true like gift of our relationship, is our willingness to hear what each other has to say and what each other is going through and what each other is thinking about, and our willingness to share whatever it is that's on our mind. For some people in relationships, certain subject matter is taboo. There's nothing taboo in Allie and my relationship. And I think a lot of that has to do with how she was raised. A lot of it has to do with how I was raised. A lot of it, again, is temperament. A lot of it might just be genetic, but it's also her training. Her background in psychology allows for her to listen to the most intimate details of someone's life. And so I am of no threat to her. She's heard way worse than what I've got going on in my mind, at least I think, from what I know of her work and her studies and her experience. And so we've grown up together. I met her when I was 25 years old in a bar, and we've been, you know, lockstep for the last 21 years, married for 18, and it's been an amazing ride. So the fact that she's, and so sometimes I joke with her, I'm like, are you my psychologist or am I your psychologist? Yes. And I think sometimes she does need me to bounce ideas off, and but she's the one that's specifically trained, and she's wonderful, and she has got great clients that she's helping every single day. She's exhausted, so I gotta step things up here a little bit quickly.
So you talk about you know, work life and turning off and the kids give you a hard time, doing what she does and hearing, like, let's say, for lack of a better word, a lot of negativity, you know, and dealing with other people's problems. Does she sometimes take that home?
Yeah, I think that it's almost impossible not to. I think if you're a human being and you're walking on this earth and you observe something in the street or you dedicate your professional life to dealing with other people's problems, it's impossible not to bring them home. I think they're draining for her. I think she's really exhausted by it. I think she's really good at what she does because she cares so much about wanting to try to find these people the answer, the help that they need to kind of like turn that light bulb on. But as far as our relationship suffering as a result, I don't sense any of that. In fact, I was going to mention in my last answer to your question that we're so compatible in that we're different, but I don't want your audience to think that anything is gender specific. There are things that she's much better at that many people in the 1950s or 60s might associate with the male behavior. And there are certain things that I do that I'm much better at than her that are more feminine. Like I'm probably more domesticated than her. Like I'm the one that makes the beds. I'm the one that likes to clean the dishes.
Awesome.
I have a particular way of keeping the house. And she is very good about disciplining the kids and making sure that their homework is done and making sure that that is a very, very important part of what our life is about. And so, yeah.
Awesome.
And it's so compatible because I don't want to deal with the things that she's good at and she doesn't want to deal with the things that I'm good at. So it's like, as long as it gets done, we're both happy.
Sounds like you figured it out.
So far, we're good.
So one more question on this topic, then we'll tie it up in a bow. Somebody's out there listening that is maybe on the fence. Do I, you know, pull the plug or maybe do I continue to give this a go, this relationship? What nuggets of wisdom or secret sauce could you impart on them?
Well, wow. To try to relate to the person who's contemplating pulling the plug on a relationship is I guess, fortunately for me, hard to relate to.
I'm saying in the context of you guys have figured out how to make it work.
Yeah.
You're different, and in that difference, you embraced it, and you guys are making it work. And so how do they make it work, essentially?
So, and again, it's always you know, relationship specific. There are no two people who are the same. There are no two relationships that are the same. The outward appearance of a relationship is generally very different than what's really going on behind closed doors. And, you know, again, ultimately, what I have found in just my life experience, I don't do what you do with the matrimonial law, so you hear much more of this than I do. But just in observing even my parents and those that have been divorced, friends who are going through troubling times in their relationships, it sometimes comes down to the things that, and I don't mean to judge, but are petty, things that could have been avoided and worked out through good, clear communication, fearless communication. A lot of times the troubles that partners will have is a result of jealousy, fear, incompatibility, even though there isn't any, because they're unwilling to discuss their needs openly and directly.
Awesome.
And I think that if you can overcome some of that trepidation that you might feel could hurt your partner's feelings, finding the right words to diplomatically get across what you need to without hurting that other person. Because again, what I found that the relationships that are most troubled that I have observed are those where scar tissue has been left behind. If you have said something to your partner or done something to your partner that even though your partner claims they've gotten over, they will have never gotten over. There is a subconscious aspect of every relationship. So if you are overly protective of making sure that your partner never feels vulnerable or insecure in your presence or by your actions, then you're pretty safe. And communicate, communicate, communicate. If you have a new need or a new desire, don't be afraid of the person you call best friend. They're your best friend for a reason. Be careful with the semantics. Be careful with how you approach it because you don't want to hurt someone's feelings unintentionally and then leave that scar tissue that I was just referring to. But if you can approach it in a delicate and diplomatic way and bring them into the discussion and make them a part of it, there are so many wonderful, amazing things that you can achieve with your partner as opposed to thinking that life would be better apart.
I think there are two therapists in the Zoom house. This is awesome. So I gotta say, thank you so much.
Thank you
You've
so much.
You've been awesome. if somebody wants to call you
yeah.
to do their real estate transaction, or if they want to get amazing, you know,
counseling on relationship advice,
how do they reach you?
I'd rather you call me with relationship advice or networking advice. The real estate is great. They can reach me in three ways, right? We have an email, I have an office line, and I have a cell phone. My email address is the letter J, the spelling of my last name, which is Z as in zebra, I, M as in Mary, N as in Nancy, E-R, at J, B as in boy, Z as in zebra, LAW.com. My phone number at the office is 212-952-4369. And of course, if you want to try me on my cell, which is probably the easiest and best way to get in touch with me, that number is 646-594-6682.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. As one last question.
Yeah, please.
I ask all my guests.
Okay.
It's probably going to be the hardest question for you.
Yeah.
I'm a sneaker guy. I don't know if you know that about me.
I do.
What's your favorite sneaker?
Ooh. So I do have a favorite sneaker, and it was one that I had in seventh grade, and it was probably the most expensive pair of shoes that I had for like my entire life, and then for the following 20 or 25 years. I had two pair of the Jordan, where it's the Jordan 4, like the netting, the rubber netting on the side, was that the Jordan 4?
Yeah.
So I had the black pair initially, and then I got the powder blue and white.
Okay.
Jordan. So I had two pair. One I only wore for basketball, and the other I wore as like the cool guy that got to rock the Jordans, just like doing whatever. So those were probably the two best sneakers, most memorable sneakers, because I knew they were super expensive at the
time.
Still
wearing these?
No, I don't have. Now my sneakers are Hokas, and like I do it because they feel comfortable. Like
I'm an old man
with a bad back.
I got a bunion. Trust me. It's like a Twilight Zone. I got all these Jordans I can't wear now.
Oh man. So what's your favorite?
I'm a Jordan 1 guy. These are 11s.
Oh wow.
How cool are these?
Those are very cool.
I have a confession to make, actually.
Yeah.
I got these for my older son, who's 17. I got these for his bar mitzvah, for him. He wore these for the bar mitzvah, but his foot.
We might
grew,
not want to talk and, about yeah. that so much then, here on so the podcast.
Anyway,
sorry, Christina.
No, it's all good. No. Christina was there at the bar mitzvah.
She was.
And speaking of, and then I'll close this out.
Yeah.
You wanted to go see Sesame Street, okay? Ask Christina the next time you see her. You want to see the Snuffleupagus jacket, all right?
Done. I love it.
Thanks so much, man.
Thank you so much. Yes, absolutely.